Yeah, good morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. It is March 21st, 2023. The time is 9 o'clock. Present here are the members of the Finance Committee, Co-Chair Hoffman, Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, and myself, Co-Chair Olson. Thank you all for being here. Please silence your cell phones. I also want to recognize that we have Senator Giesel and former Speaker John Harris in the audience that are here this morning. We have one bill that we're presenting this morning, Senate Bill 107, by the Finance Committee, the Permanent Fund Dividend and POMV Split. Although public testimony on this bill is on the agenda, I do not intend to open the public hearing meeting today. We'll have to wait for a later meeting. Therefore, if anybody's online hoping to testify, I apologize that we won't be able to hear you today. To introduce this bill, Ken Alper from my staff will walk us through a brief presentation. Mr. Alper, please put yourself on the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. Staff to yourself, Senator Olson, and the Senate Finance Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present the committee's bill, Senate Bill 107, percent of market value split on the PFD. It's a relatively straightforward bill. The syntax, it's about 4 pages long. It's very similar to other bills that have been before the committee, and it establishes a split in statute for the annual percent of market value draw, the 5% from the look-back value of the permanent fund that gets spent every year. 75% of that number would be retained by the general fund. The other 25% would pass through the general fund and then be appropriated to pay for permanent fund dividends. I'd like to remind the committee and yourself, Senate Bill 26 was the big change that implemented the percent of market value. It passed in the 2018 legislative session, although it was mostly debated in 2017. And that, although the versions of the bill that were debated and passed both bodies had a split formula within them, that split was not retained into the final version of the conference committee. So we were left with the original 1980s dividend formula remaining on statute. So SB 107 would replace that formula with one in the bill, the 75-25. This topic has been before the Finance Committee several times. The version that passed the Senate and came out of Finance in 2017 of SB 26 itself had the 75-25 split in it. So this replicates work that has been previously done. There have been three other bills that came out of this committee that made it to rules over the last several years. I list the names at the bottom of slide number two. The most recent one, you may recall from last session, Senate Bill 53, actually had a conditional dividend in it, so it was a smaller number. And then if a revenue trigger were hit of, I believe in that version of the bill, it was $700 million, the dividend would ratchet up and reset to a 50-50 going forward. So this is ground that's been well plowed. You've brought it before the committee one more time for this year because it hasn't quite passed in the past. So I'm on slide three, but I should probably pause for questions before I move ahead.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? Not Mr. Alper, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So backing up 40, 50 years, the permanent fund was set aside more or less for when we needed it, for when oil would no longer be able to cover all of the state's budgetary needs. So here we are. We've been using the permanent fund as part of basic budgeting needs for this is the sixth year, I suppose. Not having a PFD formula in statute creates a certain uncertainty, which all members of this committee are aware of. The POMV was supposed to stabilize our revenue, and it has. We have $3.5 plus billion coming in the next fiscal year, which is remarkable and a tribute to past generations that have been able to set that money aside. But although that revenue is stabilizing the revenue, if we don't know what portion of that is going to the dividend until very late in the legislative session, it's really hard to know what we have when making budgetary decisions, capital budget, different spending increases, what we're able to afford. So it just makes it more complicated. But the concept of setting the knowing what the dividend formula is going to be will make it easier to do all of the rest of your work going forward. Now, if we're talking about methodologies, how would we divide up the POMV, the percent of market value draw? Using a percentage split makes sense logically, mathematically, planning-wise. The bullets here on slide number four, let's just sort of walk through this. The POMV itself is tied to the overall value of the fund. The fund does move up and down with markets, of course, but it's relatively stable. Our POMV draw has increased a little bit every year from $2.7 billion the first year it was in place in FY19 to $3.5 billion this year. But we know with some accuracy what it is going to be 2 or 3 years from now. We can predict it. Whereas the old statutory dividend formula, members will recall, we all got them in years past, bounced around a lot. Could be 800 1 year, 1500 the next year, that sort of thing. And the reason was it was tied to earnings of the permanent fund itself. Earnings are a lot more volatile. So if you imagine a world where we have a dividend that's based on a volatile earnings formula and a POMV that's tied to a stable asset value formula, if what the general fund keeps is whatever is left after the dividend, the general fund's money is also volatile. So pinning down the dividend helps us pin down the revenue, which helps us build a budget. So it's really all about systematizing and making everybody's work easier going forward and reducing the uncertainty. I'll pause here for a moment.
I have a comment on going back to slide three. It says the permanent fund was initially set aside for when oil would no longer be able to cover all budgetary needs. It's true that for a long time, oil has not been able to cover our budgetary needs. The thing that makes it up is the permanent fund itself earnings have been able to go ahead and take over much of the budgetary process. Isn't that true?
Mr. Chairman, before the passage of SB 26 in 2018, we did not use the permanent fund earnings itself for general government. Other than funding dividends, permanent fund earnings went to a few permanent fund management-related tasks, running the corporation, of course, paying the staff at the Department of Revenue that receive applications and review them and so on, some legal services. The real mechanism when oil wasn't covering us was the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, which was set aside from settlements and litigation, large chunks of money that were coming in, and the legislature would draw that down when we had a shortfall and then theoretically at least pay it back when we had a surplus. A lot of the paying back occurred at this table in the 2007 through 2010 period, and about $5.5 billion was put back into the Constitutional Budget Reserve. And then starting in 2014, we started drawing it down again.
Any further questions for Mr. Alper on either slide three or four?
So that's the why is it necessary background of getting into a little bit more of the guts. Why did we pick 75-25? It's fiscally prudent. It's what makes the budget balance. It's what's affordable, at least as we sit right now. There's a table on this page that was taken from a fiscal summary, a summary document that OMB Director Steiniger brought before this committee last month. And you can see the green circle at the bottom, the general fund budget based on this is government, the governor's budget with all of his amendments brought in by the 30-day of session was $433.5 million in the red. We were in deficit. Just as an aside, and it's not on the slide, the other bodies, Finance Committee introduced their budget, put it out yesterday. There wasn't that much changed from the governor's budget. They added $30 million for community assistance. We've talked about that a little at this table. So that would bring the deficit to $460, but then they shifted to a dividend structure based on 50-50. That's what's in their budget right now. There's roughly a $700 million shift between the governor's proposed and 50-50. So they have a budget that's $250 million in surplus. But that's based on the fall forecast. We haven't talked about the spring forecast yet, which will be before the committee tomorrow. This $433 million deficit, meanwhile, is before the committee and the legislature has done very much to it. community assistance is $30 million. The university was here at the beginning of session talking about their massive deferred maintenance needs. There's a lot that's been underinvested in. Any other additions to the capital budget, all of you, your members and their districts are asking for needs. Education funding is a major issue before the legislature. There's a bill in this committee that has a fiscal note of a couple hundred million dollars at least. And then any bills that pass with fiscal notes, several of which come from the governor himself. So these numbers are going to get larger. And meanwhile, there really aren't savings pools. Unlike past years, there isn't a statutory budget reserve. There aren't any sort of pots of money that were put aside in previous years that could be drawn down. The only savings remaining is the constitutional budget reserve. And as you well know, that requires a supermajority vote to access. And there has not been a successful constitutional budget reserve vote that made it through both bodies with supermajority since 2020. It's been 3 years, so it would probably not be prudent to rely on that, assuming that that would be able to happen. We probably need to build a budget that fits within the money that we have before us, the POMV plus regular revenue from the oil and other industries that we tax.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm now on slide 6. The right side of the page is a slide that Legislative Finance Division brought before the committee earlier in the session, just sort of highlighting some of the other holes in our future, unmet needs, the biggest, and there's a lot of small print there that I've summarized over to the left. There's the state's pension obligation, which is sitting at about $7 billion. There's a number of capital needs. I mentioned deferred maintenance, school construction list, that kind of thing adds up to $4.4 billion. And then the state's various debt service or shared municipal debt service is another $1.6 billion. So we have $13 billion worth of stacked up need out there. And we need to be certainly careful with our cash as we figure out how we're going to address that. Now on slide number 7, back to the 75-25 formula. The rest of this week is going to be very interesting, I believe, in the Finance Committee. I'm personally looking forward to what the Department of Revenue brings us for the spring forecast. But realistically, it's going to be lower than the fall forecast. The official price of oil for FY24, which begins this July 1st, was $81 a barrel. Today, we're sitting at around $72 a barrel, and the department tends to forecast based on the futures market. I don't know exactly what the futures market was last week, but it was less than 81. So there's going to be a few dollars downward revision in the price of oil next year. Each dollar's adjustment is roughly $70 million. So we're looking at a several hundred million dollar shift in the expected revenue that you're going to see before this committee tomorrow, when I believe Senator Stedman will have the gavel. Production is trending a bit below forecast also. That'll probably ratchet things down a tiny notch. And then we have the Willow project incoming. Willow is going to be great for the state in myriad ways, jobs, production, and even tax revenue eventually. But because of the way our tax structure is constructed, there will be some short-term negative revenue aspects to Willow. As they start spending money, it will be an offset against the owner of that field's other assets from the North Slope, and we will actually see a reduction in taxes outside of what's in the forecast documents. And that's something we need to be aware of. So we might have about $1 billion shortfall, possibly a little more going forward, that we need to address, like not just next year, but in the following years as well. We'll probably see oil prices adjusted a little bit downward for the next 5 or 10 years. And meanwhile, this is a small adjustment, but we should be aware the POMV itself is based on certain assumptions. The earnings of the permanent fund are slightly below forecast for this year. That will have another adjustment, maybe $50, $100 million in future years' percent of market value draws. So that we'll see a little bit of an adjustment on that as well.
Before we go on, can you just kind of give us a ballpark figure about what kind of shortfall we're going to have with the Willow project coming on? Is it billions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, or a few million dollars?
Mr. Chairman, what's the total capital spend going to be? We don't know. Probably around $5 billion to get that field built and ready to produce over a number of years. The way that, and let's throw a presumption out there, that the price of oil has to be high enough that we're above the minimum tax crossover. And I don't want to get into technical aspects of the oil tax at this table on this bill. We'll have plenty of time for that at another time, I'm sure. But if we're above the minimum tax, then all of that spending will be used to reduce the owner's profits from, you know, it's ConocoPhillips, and they're also a major producer at Kuparuk and Alpine and Prudhoe Bay, so they have other profits in Alaska. Over a number of years, that $5 billion will reduce their profits, and which are subject to the tax rate of 35%. Now, no one's actually paying 35%. The per barrel credit is subtracted after the tax calculation, but the tax rate of 35% is what matters. The Willow won't affect the per barrel credit at all. So 35% of $5 billion is $1.75 billion. So we're looking at about a $1.75 billion negative revenue hit over a 5 or 6 year period.
Is it going to be equally distributed during that period of time?
Mr. Chairman, I can riff on this, but on Thursday you'll have the Department of Revenue sitting here with some actual graphics that are looking at this. Roughly speaking, it gets bigger year by year up until right before they're done. Then this is a giant construction project that gets ramped up and gets more intense. And then then they're done and they start producing oil. But so it'll probably grow gradually over a 4 or 5 year period.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this is another slide from Legislative Finance from Alexi Painter from last month. I believe we'll see an updated version of it later in the week. But without looking at all the different charts and numbers and what they mean, I think visually the most important thing to see here is that it's green. The bars to the left in very many other versions of this slide have big red blocks on them. Red means we're in the negative. We have an overdraw. We are no longer fitting within our 5% of market value. This is the scenario that roughly parallels the bill before you, the 75-25 split, and it's a balanced budget with certain assumptions. And that includes an increase by the legislature to the capital budget, funding community assistance, and a few other things, and a gradual building of the value in the constitutional budget reserve. We're actually running a bit of a surplus in this. This will be less rosy because of the revenue adjustments that will be brought in later in the week. But roughly speaking, Mr. Chairman, 75-25 balances the budget given a certain set of assumptions.
Mr. Alper, as I look at this graph here, you're saying we should be happy with that because there's not any much red on there. But what does that mean to the common man on the street who's semi-dependent on his permanent fund dividend to make sure his family doesn't go hungry?
So, Mr. Chairman, there's roughly four ways to balance the budget. You know, one of them is to draw down savings, and I said earlier in my comments, we really don't have savings to draw down reliably anyway. Number two would be to cut the budget in some way. Judging by the cuts in the past years and the debate that I've witnessed this legislative session, there's not a tremendous appetite to make aggressive cuts to the budget. Number three would be to reduce the permanent fund dividend in some way. Reduce is maybe a loaded word, but to readjust the dividend from one formula to another, that's creating the ability to balance the budget. The fourth would be to add new revenue, taxes of some sort. If there was a desire by the legislature to fund a larger dividend and the other parts aren't moving, let's find some revenue. You know, I've done that elsewhere in my career, and I enjoy working with the committee to help do that. But the red in the context of this slide, where Mr. Painter is projecting things, what it really means is we'd be overdrawing the permanent fund. And I guess that's the fifth thing. If we break the percent of market value formula and take more than the 5%, a number of bad things start to happen, including that every future percent of market value draw gets progressively smaller and we run the risk of crashing the whole system. And thankfully, Mr. Chairman, I believe we have pretty strong consensus in your committee here that we don't want to go down that path.
Seems to be the flavor. Any further questions, Mr. Alper? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Alper. I'm a little bit colorblind here on the slide, on in this slide to the left column. That's the Is that the ARPA overdraw? My eyes are tricking me on the kind of brown.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, there's a thin brown slice at the top of the stack. Just clear, that's what we're talking about. The leftmost bar is the current fiscal year, FY23, so that's the already approved budget from last year. And yes, what you're seeing there is the tail end of the roughly $1 billion that the state got from the last of the pandemic major federal bills. That was 100 some odd million dollars, I think, maybe 300 million of the remnant of that money was used to balance the FY23 budget. If we had FY22 on this chart, you'd see the same brown a little bit thicker.
Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Bishop. Go ahead, Mr. Alper. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I guess, Mr. Alper, I appreciate the presentation focus on our ability to meet Alaskans' needs with state services, right? Keeping the doors locked on the prisons and keeping troopers on the beat, plowing roads and running ferries. Can you talk to us a little bit about the impact on the other side of the equation, which is 75-25? What does that make the PFD check, and how does that compare to the last, I don't know, 10-year average or 15-year average?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair to Senator Keel, the PFD at 75-25 this year, and again, it shifts every year a little bit, will be $1,300, $1,350. That's roughly in alignment with the historic long-term average. It's also roughly in alignment with the near-term average. There, in the time period since the first, let's call it reduced dividend, which was by veto, and then the legislature made dividends based on available funds and policy choices for several years, we've been in that 1,000 to 1,600 range, so we'd be right in the middle of that pack. Last year, for a variety of reasons, was a bit of an outlier. We had a $3,000 dividend. I'll remind yourself and the committee of some of the volatility. The PFD in 2000 and I want to say 13 was $900, and in 2014 it went to $1,900, and that goes back to the old earnings formula. There was a market crash in 2008. That fell off the five-year look-back tail in 2014, so all of a sudden the dividend doubled. And that speaks to stabilizing the formula. But the short answer to your question is this would put us in the $1,300 range, which would be roughly in line with historical averages.
Thank you.
But to put everything in context, I think the money that was given out last year had an energy portion to it, wasn't that right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The actual statutory construction in the budget last year was that we paid a 50-50 dividend. 50% was $2,600, and then there was an additional $400 some million that was characterized as an energy bonus that added another $600 and some to it. So the total $3,284 was a bit of a hybrid. To remind any Alaskans watching at home, that $600 is tax-free according to the federal government. So make sure you work with your accountant to not pay income taxes on your entire PFD from last year.
Okay. Senator Halpin, do you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that the bill before us and the decision to finally decide the dividend split is probably the most important piece of legislation that we can do to stabilize government and spending. But everyone at this table and the people that are watching are well aware that the amount of the dividend is politically charged. Every individual that receives a dividend has their own opinion, and it seems as though the number continues to be north of whatever comes out of the legislature. And many individuals feel that the current formula, which all of us at this table know is unreasonable, is something that they believe is state law, and those are their dollars. So with that premise, to come up with this particular piece of legislation, I support as a starting point to open the dialogue. It may not be the final solution, but I strongly believe that this session is the session that we need to have a final decision. You look at what the House of Representatives did that was mentioned at this table on a 50-50 split. In isolation, it balances. The problem that I see is that if you look at that same scenario and try to apply a 50-50 dividend, and the action that they took clearly is not on the formula itself. It's a one-time allocation, which is the problem that we've been facing. But if you look on the long term, I believe that the 50-50 will put us into the red, which many members have mentioned. And that is why I think we need to look at a fair split, and whatever that is, bring more people to the table and consider additional revenue measures. There's been a lot of talk in this building, on the other, in the other body, and on the third floor, that we need to look at additional revenues and to come up with a split. For those that that looked at the Finance Committee last year, we had that you'd mentioned, we had Senate Bill 53, I believe, that had a 75-25 split, and then it had a stair-stepping mechanism to go up to a 50-50 dividend. I think that some measure of that concept, where individuals would know that we may be able to get up to a 50-50 dividend if we find additional revenues, is something that should be considered. So there's a lot of pressure at the ballot box when candidates are running for office. The first question many people ask, are you a full dividender? And if you respond yes, your favorability in the ballot box would go up considerable. But if it's no, the reverse effect takes place. So what I'm saying is that if you have a formula at a 75-25 and then start gradually looking at, or have a trigger mechanism to go up to a 50-50, then the dynamic in the ballot box is, are you willing to support new taxes to get a 50-50 dividend? I think that will change the dynamic, and that is something that I think this committee should look at very seriously. And I think it balances a starting point, possibly at 75-25, but in the long term, we will end up with a 50-50 split, which people can identify with, and I think that would receive a broader support from the individuals that are watching this particular, and those are basically every adult voter. But I would like to say that the position that the House of Representatives did on 50-50 is unattainable on the long run if we are unable to come up with additional revenue measures, and we will soon, very, very soon, be in a negative scenario situation for the state of Alaska, which will put us, I believe, into a nosedive. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Merritt, did you have a comment?
No.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things that we've mentioned here before. The 50-50 concept goes back several decades, and the split between the citizens and basically the treasury of the state on the revenue, 50% of it went out to dividends, and then there was inflation proofing. And then the 50% that was the state share, the state reinvested it. and they reinvested that share for over 40 years or so, somewhere in that range, thereby allowing the permanent fund to swell substantially, and that number could be almost, you know, double what it would have been otherwise. So now we fast forward 35, 40 years, and we're talking about a 50-50 split, but we're not taking into account the savings component that the state mandated by not, from their share, by not taking their share out every year. So we need to take that, and I know it's hard to explain to the public, and a lot of them don't want to hear about it. They just want to know how big the check is. But when we look at the long run, as referenced here in a previous discussion by Senator Hoffman, it's got to be economically viable, and it's got to be viable to the point where it puts us in a better position than we are today. Because I think we're going to hear that we're below our minimum recommended balance of our savings accounts from legislative finance, and that at the basically the minimum account balance from recommendations from OMB. So we can't afford to go backwards anymore from where we are today financially. And when we put a system together, whatever it is, it's got to stand the test of time, not for, you know, 5 years, but hopefully for 40, 50 years. And if we have to come back here in 6 years or 4 years or 3 years and change the formula again, that's even going to be we're going to be in a worse position. So I think we need to, you know, be a little careful that we make sure that whatever we do, the math works and has a reasonable chance of working. And I think we're going to find that the 75-25 concept that's in front of us today, and that was also in front of this committee in 2017, has survived the test of time for those years, and we've gone through some real horrible markets. But it's still not 100% certainty that we're not going to have challenges to meet those obligations, and particularly, I think, when we see our financial updates coming. And the long run might be less than 24 hours when we take a look at the budget that's looks like it's coming to us with about a $200 to $250 million surplus from the other body, depending on what actions they do on the floor, assume none, then that number would be in that ballpark. But my expectation is we're going to get a bigger revenue move tomorrow than we have in that surplus. In other words, I expect for this committee to be facing a deficit in 24 with a 50-50 dividend. We'll find out tomorrow when the numbers are released and when we thoroughly scrub it to make sure everything passes the red face test on forward expectations of oil prices. But we also have FY23, the current year, to survive and get through, and we might be underwater there, $200, $250 million. So people may want a 50-50 dividend, or they maybe want three-quarters of the coming out of the permanent fund. Frankly, it's irrelevant if you can't make your obligations, you can't make payroll. You've got to deal with the economic reality that the cards are handed to us. And I think as we go forward, we're going to have those conversations. And I just hope everybody keeps a flexible, some flexibility in what, you know, they will accept as a conclusion. Because there's things that are totally out of our control in the economics of the oil industry that dictates half of our revenue, or a third of it, or depending on the year, significant amount. So we might have to make some rather unpleasant decisions or go insolvent. And that's not an insolvent. I mean, you go into the permanent fund and you start just taking out whatever you want, whenever you want it. That's just unacceptable. So we'll see how it shakes out. We're going to have an interesting week, and then we'll reset this presentation. I think Friday is scheduled to be reset. I want the public to take what they see today as just kind of historical information about what we worked on, because the numbers are going to be moving on Friday.
Mr. Alper? I'm sorry, Senator.
I just want to put just one more little finer point on Senator Stedman's comments. on the 50% that the state didn't take for over 40-some years, that also accounts for the above and beyond $9 billion deposit that the legislature put in there, too.
Mr. Alper.
Mr. Chairman, the last three senators that spoke, I don't think there's a question for me in there. I think they spoke quite well for themselves. So I'm just going to continue on with the presentation. And this was the last substantive slide that you have, kind of laying out what's now month-old graphic that you'll see updated in a few days once, like Senator Stedman says, the new revenue numbers are on the table at the end of the week. You'll have legislative finance up here on Friday. The next slide is a sectional analysis. I can run through that really quickly. You and all members have seen a version of this before. We are inside the permanent fund statutes in AS 3713. We're getting rid of overwriting the original formula that looks back at 21% of 5 years of statutory net income. This is language that was removed in Senate Bill 26, the version that passed the Senate, put back in the conference committee. So Section 1 gets rid of that and amends the 5% POMV just to say that you can't spend past, of course, what's in the earnings reserve account. To make a small aside, whatever the volatility is, the permanent fund is secure forever with a 5% draw, but we do run the risk potentially of crashing the earnings reserve if we get a couple of bad market years. Mr. Painter looks at that later on. That's what they call the failure rate. That's a whole separate conversation that if we wanted to resolve that would require going to some form of a single account structure outside the scope of this bill. Section 2 gets rid of the dividend formula that was tied to the old earnings formula and replaces it with 25% of the percent of market value. The rest of the bill is conforming. We want to make it clear that the appropriation to the principal, so-called inflation proofing, is subject to appropriation. We want to carve out the Amaretta Hess earnings, which that's continuing to happen. A particular set of the permanent fund's money is not used in the dividend calculation, having to do with an issue of a tainted jury from about 1990. We want to exclude the mental health trust earnings. As you know, the permanent fund is also in the business of managing money for the Alaska Mental Health Trust, but the mental health trust earnings are not part of our POMV and not part of our dividend. And then the immediate effective date, and that's the one thing the committee might want to be aware of. If you wished to pass this bill through the legislative process and have it be what governs the dividend that will be in the coming budget cycle and pay it out this fall, you probably need an immediate effective date, and this bill has one. And that is it for slides, and I'm happy to take any additional questions or move on to the next presenter.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just another word of caution for new information rolling at us. I think the permanent fund is going to have an adjustment on their realized earnings for FY23. And so we'll get that updated to us. So that will move down the statutory dividend calculation that we've all assumed is the statutory dividend in the presented budget by the governor. That'll move that down. It'll still be north of the 50-50 dividend that the other body has, but we have the dynamics not only of the oil field and oil prices to deal with, we got the dynamics of the financial markets. So it's not like we're working in a static marketplace. So we'll have those updates when permanent fund is ready to release them to us.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand that a 50-50 today does not work, you know, and that's why I think that, you know, we look at the 75-25, and there has to be decisions that address how we get there. It's going to be very difficult and uneasy. But in order to knowing the politics in this building as well as the average person, we need to come up with something that works for the people of Alaska, for the people at this table, for the other body, and for the third floor. So what I'm saying is that in order to accomplish a 50-50, the The hard decisions are additional revenue in order to get the split done. So I'm willing, ready, willing, and able to make those tough decisions, and I hope all of my colleagues at this table are also willing to make those tough financial decisions. That's what we're here for. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wondering here, Mr. Alpler, on Senate Bill 107, would this prohibit an additional, let's say, if the legislature decides a later date to do a 25% energy fund rebate, would that be prohibited in this bill?
Mr. Alpler.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, absolutely not. The legislature controls the appropriation process. The permanent fund dividend is subject to appropriation. The Supreme Court told you that. If we have the funds and you and your other senators would like to give more than what the statutory formula provides for, you're absolutely free to do so. In fact, that's what happened last year with that energy bonus.
Thank you.
Follow up, Senator Wilson. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Alper, is the POMB a spending cap?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, it is a revenue cap, certainly, and I guess it could be broken if you wanted to, although few would recommend it. And presuming that spending is tied to what you have, it is, by extension, a spending cap, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alper. Before we go on to our next presenter, do you have any fiscal notes related to this bill?
Mr. Chairman, there is a fiscal note from the Department of Revenue. It's a zero fiscal note, and really they're just talking about implementation. They wouldn't be doing anything different. They're waiting every year to find out what the dividend is going to be anyway. The real change in this bill will come in the on the budgeting side, which is outside the fiscal note. So, no, there should not be any material cost to implement this bill, and we haven't seen any fiscal notes that say so yet.
Okay. Any further questions, Mr. Alper, by members of the committee? If not, if there are no further questions, we'll have Alexa Painter, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. He has additional slides that look at the potential fiscal impact of Senate Bill 107. Mr. Painter, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. And I will be presenting a couple of fiscal modeling slides for the committee. And I guess I'll just get right into the revenue assumptions. So these slides will be using the fall revenue forecast. As we're all aware, we're about to replace this with the spring forecast. So on Friday, I will be back before this committee to update these slides to the spring revenue forecast. I recommend that people use those versions of the slides as the data that I'm presenting today will be stale in a matter of a few hours. So, you know, this can show you directionally the impact of the bill, but again, we're getting a spring forecast very soon. So we're doing these slides with the fall revenue forecast, which shows $81 oil in FY24. And the production forecast increasing from 500,000 barrels to about 540,000. And then for the permanent fund, we're using Callan's total return assumption of 7% in FY23 and then 7.05% thereafter. On the spending side, for agency operations, we are assuming that the governor's budget, including amendments received through February 14th, so that's the official gov mandate, grows with inflation. The governor did submit additional amendments on March 7th. Those are not included here. The slide that Mr. Alper showed earlier was showing the governor's December 15th budget. So the difference between this, the models that I'll show here and the ones from a month ago or so are the impact of the governor's amendments, which increased agency operations. For statewide items, these models assume all items are funded to their statutory levels in FY24 and beyond. That includes school debt reimbursement, the REAA fund, community assistance, and oil and gas tax credits. All of those except for community assistance were funded to the statutory level in the governor's budget. For the capital budget, the committee has asked us to use a $400 million capital budget assumption. The governor's amended capital budget is just over $300 million, so that's about a $97 million increase over the governor's budget. and then growing with inflation at 2.5% per year. For supplementals, we're assuming $50 million per year, although the governor's supplementals are the assumption in FY23. And then for the PFD, again, this is modeling SB 107, so it is we are following that 25% POMV draw for dividends.
I'm sorry, Senator Wilson.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Painter, for Director Painter, for talking about the capital budget. That is a pretty large capital budget, but it also seems like a pretty small supplemental in past years as well. Is there a way to a better number that we should look at in terms of modeling for future modeling?
Mr. Painter.
Through the Chair, Senator Wilson, so the $50 million is based on the average amount of supplemental appropriations after considering lapsing funds each year. So each year there's kind of two adjustments to get from our original budget to the actuals. The first would be the supplementals we add, and then the next would be the lapse coming back. And the $50 million is kind of the pre-COVID average lapse. We had higher lapse for a few years while COVID was disrupting some agencies. So that is based on historical average. We've usually the actual supplemental bill is for significantly more than $50 million, but then we get something like $35 to $50 million of lapse the last few years with Medicaid, FMAP issues, and other things. We've had significantly more lapse, but and more supplementals. So that 50 is sort of, we're trying to balance those two things to come up with a number. You know, in the governor's 10-year plan, they've used zero for supplementals, arguing that supplementals and lapse would balance out. But the $50 million is sort of the average we've seen of the net of those. And then the capital budget assumption, I think the chairs may be able to speak to that. That was a choice that that the chairs indicated, not one that we choose.
And just as a follow-up then, what would be the historical average for the capital budget?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, so it varies heavily depending on available revenue. I'm not sure that we could pick one average that would be a representative because we've had years with a $2 billion UGF capital budget and years with a $107 million UGF capital budget, I believe is the low. We've tried to do an exercise before figuring out what is a baseline capital budget, and I think there's so many policy choices and interactions with available revenue that it's difficult to have an objective number for that.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just maybe to help with that, if you can get back to the committee on the historic capital budget for about 20 years, sounds like a good number, turn of the century, 23 years. And then factor out, if you could, the or separate out the federal match, because we always go for that. So we put down 10 cents and get a dollar back from the federal government. That takes care of most of our roads and Marine Highway and things like that. And then after the federal match, maybe put that stuff in another category so we could see basically the general fund capital budget, because that's the funds that are at the table here when we decide to build a museum, state museum and archive building in Juneau, or we want to build, you know, something in another prison, or what we're going to, you know, whatever we're going to do, bridges, if it's outside the STIP, because that would, I think, help highlight the issue of if we're going to drive infrastructure, it's well beyond just what the federal government will match us on a pothole repair on the highways.
Through the chair, Senator Sedman, I can bring that back on Friday when I return to the committee. And one thing I may add is information about general obligation bonds, which have been used, you know, as another tool to pay for capital. So that would be part of the whole picture of how we've funded our capital budgets over the past two decades.
Senator Bishop.
I'm going to reserve my comments on the capital budget for a later date.
Mr. Painter.
Mr. Chairman, going on to slide five. So we've talked about in the committee the constitutional budget reserve target balance. The Office of Management and Budget has testified that $500 million is needed in that for cash flow. And then the question is how much is needed as a shock absorber as well. And in Alaska, we don't have a formal reserves target. OMB has told this committee that they're targeting $2 billion in the constitutional budget reserve. to serve as that $500 million in cash flow and then some level of shock absorption. So based on the fall revenue forecast, Ledge Finance did a calculation based on the state of Minnesota's rule. That's the only state that we could find that had a volatility-based reserves target. The others just set a percentage of their budget, so they're not something we can really translate here. We have the most volatile revenue in the country, so rules that work elsewhere perhaps don't, but we can at least calculate the Minnesota target, so that's the one we use as a baseline. That target is essentially targeting reserves levels such that there's a 95% probability that the budget will be funded for the next 2 years based on the projected revenue volatility. So using our model, we projected that you would need a CBR balance of about $3.5 billion based on the fall forecast, assuming that you have a budget that balances based on the fall forecast. With the spring forecast, you would have a lower oil revenue picture, which would mean you would need less reserves to get there, except that you would need to balance your budget at a significantly lower price. So if you're factoring in, you know, what's a reasonable reserves level, it depends on if you can balance your budget at $72 oil or $81 oil. If you have a budget that balances at a lower price, you would need less in reserves. So that number is a bit of a moving target based on where you're trying to balance your budget. But that $3.5 billion seemed like a reasonable number to us based on the fall forecast.
Mr. Painter, as you look at the difference between the first bullet point where you have $500 million and $2 billion in cash flow and the recommendation by OMB, why is there a $1 billion difference between that and $3.5 billion if you go after the Minnesota model?
Mr. Chairman, I think the difference there is so cash flow, the $500 million is sort of just baseline to pay our bills. That's covering the within-year volatility. Then the next stage would be covering the between-year volatility. So the fact that our revenue can swing, you know, if we have a $10 swing in prices, that could swing revenue by $700 million from year to year. And so I think the $2 billion, I'm not sure if they had any mathematical methodology behind that, or that was just a level that is about what we have now. So it's perhaps a target to keep where we are. The $3.5 billion would allow you to cover 2 years of potential deficits if prices went down to the, you know, 50s or 60s. Whereas if you're at that $2 billion level, you could probably only last a year. So the legislature could act that quickly, potentially. But in the past, you know, it's not always easy to bring on new revenues. And so if you're trying to fix the budget at a certain price, a higher level will give you more security at a higher price if you're balancing your budget at a more volatile price.
Okay. Any further questions, Mr. Painter, by members of the committee? If not, go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman, this takes us to the first model, and again, this is with the fall forecast of SB 107, so a 75-25 split, 25% of the POMV draw going to the permanent fund dividend. And so these surplus numbers, there are still surpluses each year. They're lower than in that slide that was shown by Mr. Alper earlier because the governor's amendments are factored in. That increases the agency operation spending. So this shows a $975 million surplus in FY24, and then that shrinks gradually by FY29, and it's basically a balanced budget. So these dividend numbers you can see at the bottom, in FY24 we project that this dividend would be $1,304. By FY32 we project that would be $1,653 as the amount going to the dividend would increase faster than population. The reserves, assuming we'd have these surpluses, would grow because we'd assume the surpluses are deposited into the Constitutional Budget Reserve. So we'd end up with a CBR balance of about $6 billion by FY32, assuming that all of the surpluses went into the CBR. And I should note again that we will get the spring forecast very soon. That will show significantly lower revenue numbers in the early years, likely in the later years, relatively similar revenue numbers as the long-term futures market has not shifted as much as the short-term.
Okay. We can continue.
Mr. Chairman, going on to slide 7, talking about our probabilistic modeling. So we have two versions of our fiscal model, the linear, the linear model, which we just saw, which assumes the revenue matches DOR's forecast, and then a probabilistic model, which shows the impact of revenue volatility. The probabilistic model allows for variation in three variables: oil prices, which uses a range centered around DOR's forecast; oil production, using the range between the Department of Natural Resources high and low production forecast; and the permanent fund investment returns, using the ranges developed by Callan, our investment advisor for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. So this leaves out potential variation in non-oil revenues, which do have some volatility, and then also with inflation. We've struggled a bit to figure out what are reasonable inflationary values, but at this point, that's not incorporated into our probabilistic model. Going on to slide 8, so this is just an example of a 25th percentile result to kind of orient the committee. So in the probabilistic model, essentially you can categorize each result in terms of the impact, and by the end of the modeling period on the total reserves, and sort of look at what's a median result, which would be 50% of outcomes are better, 50% are worse. In this case, we're just showing a 25th percentile result. That means that 25% of outcomes are worse, 75% are better. So this is sort of a low case, but not necessarily the bottom. And this is an example where the average oil price is $67.20. That's lower than what the forecast would indicate. It actually, this particular scenario has high starting prices and then they decline. This actually has average permanent fund returns in excess of the forecast, but because those prices are lower than the forecast, this results in a 75th percentile outcome, or sorry, 25th percentile outcome. So to, you know, again, this is not the low extreme, and in fact, 25th percentile, here's average oil price is $67.20. That's only about, you know, $5 lower than the prices are today. It's not an outlier result, but this would show, when we see in the next slide where those lines are, this is an example of what that lower line is. This next slide shows the probabilistic output. So the median surplus deficit numbers here are very similar to what you saw in the linear model, but then we have a couple of different ways of looking at it. So on the left, we have the surplus or deficit by fiscal year, with the blue bar representing the median outcome, the green representing the 75th, the 25th and 75th percentile results. So that 25th percentile result that we saw on that last slide, that would track down with these green bars. The black bar, the black vertical line, shows the 10th through 90th percentile, so showing 80% of results will be within these black lines, or the black, within the black lines, that works. On the right, we have the range of the ending permanent fund balance, and in this case, I think it says assuming no overdraws. I think this one does have potential overdraws, but not very often with this model. The median value shows that we have a median of the realized balance of the earnings reserve declining, and that's because the 7% effect, the 7% assumed return plus 2.5% inflation is a real return of 4.5% versus our 5% POMV. So that's a expectation of a slightly declining balance. The 75th and 25th, you can see that in the 25th percentile, we would project that the ERA would go to zero in FY30, and this is despite having a balanced budget as the median, because of the probability of low investment returns that results in the ERA going to zero. That baseline exists regardless of what happens with the fiscal plan, because of the volatility in the earnings reserve account. The bottom here, we have the CBR balance probabilities showing what is the probability that the CBR is below given thresholds. So anything below 500 million, the bottom line, that's where we would assume there would need to be an overdraw of the earnings reserve. So there's a relatively low chance of that, 0% in FY24, rising slowly to about 7% by FY32. And then that the probability that the CBR would be below $3.5 billion, which was the target we talked about earlier, that probability starts out relatively high in FY24 because we're not at that target now. But if assuming there's a surplus, that would be able to build up, and the probabilities in the later years are only about 15 to 20% of the CBR being below that $3.5 billion target. And Mr. Chairman, that's all the slides I have. And again, I will have a lot more information updated on Friday for the committee.
Any questions of Mr. Painter by members of the committee? Thank you, Mr. Painter, for coming in today and testifying and showing us your slides. We're going to set aside, I'm sorry, Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, in our Constitution, Article 9, Section 16, it talks about appropriation limits. And I'm going back to the capital budget question. And it says, within this limit, at least one-third shall be reserved for capital project and loan appropriations. My question is, has the legislature always complied with that requirement? And if they didn't, how did they get away with not complying?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, so the legislature has not always complied with that limit. First, just to preface, the limit itself is sort of ambiguous how to calculate it. There's a method of calculation that the Division of Finance has used in our financial reports. That's one method. There's another method that you could interpret the same language to read that is how the Anchorage property tax cap is calculated. Those have identical wording to their formulas, but two different calculations that put the limit at several billion dollars apart. Again, it's an ambiguity, so we're going to go with the Division of Finance version for the answer to this question. Even within that, we've arguably broken that limit that essentially reserves that the operating budget cannot exceed two-thirds of the limit. That's how I would sort of interpret it from a mathematical standpoint. There was an attorney general opinion back in, I think, 1982 that said that in times of constrained revenue, that part of the limit would not necessarily be necessary to follow because the Constitution wouldn't necessarily be limiting that factor. I can send the attorney general opinion, but that's what was used back in those eras. Again, if we follow the more restrictive calculation, then we've broken the limit repeatedly over the years. If you follow the more expansive view, as the Division of Finance does, then we've perhaps violated that two-thirds a couple of times since the 80s. And again, it's unclear what the consequences would be because there's the Attorney General opinion that would tell the Division of Finance not to say that there's a problem. And also the limit is calculated after the fact. It can't be calculated until the fiscal year is closed. And so all of those expenditures have already been made by that point. It's unclear what practical effect there could be from violating a limit if you don't know until after that spending has happened. So I guess there's some legal ambiguity, but also it's very debatable exactly what that limit means.
So has there ever been a challenge by members of the Alaska resident to that?
Mr. Chairman, not to my knowledge.
What's the Attorney General opinion based on?
Mr. Chairman, the Attorney General opinion from the 80s is based on an interpretation of the Constitution and the conflicting constitutional responsibilities of the legislature to fund state government and also to comply with the limit.
Senator Stinman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we can ask Mr. Painter to take a look at that and review that and make comments on it when he brings back the historic capital budget, because it's tied in as that margin of what we should have in a capital budget under normal years.
Is that possible, Mr. Painter?
Sherman, yes.
I think it would certainly give us more information to go ahead and try and figure out what kind of capital budget we're going to have this year. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, just to make sure I'm understanding the slides, the scenario you've given us in 8 and 9, the sort of grumpy outlook, that doesn't include any additional funding for our public schools. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, correct. This is based on the governor's amended budget. It does not include that. It does not include fiscal notes for his legislation. So, for example, he has the $58 million fiscal note for an education bill. That's not included here because it's not officially part of his budget.
Mr. Chairman, just that one's Article 7, Section 1.
Okay. Any other questions from Mr. Painter by members of the committee? Now, thank you very much, Mr. Painter, for coming in. We're going to set this bill aside, Senate Bill 107, for further discussion. The rest of this week, we'll go deeper into the state's fiscal position. Tomorrow, we're going to be hearing from the Department of Revenue with the spring revenue forecast update. We expect, unfortunately, that this will probably be much lower than we have heard at the beginning of the session. Thursday, we will have revenue back, as well as the Department of Natural Resources, to talk about the Willow Oil Project on the North Slope and how it will affect the state's finances in the years to come. Friday, we'll have Mr. Painter back with an update on the state's finances. We have the update on and by that time, we'll have the updated revenue forecast. With that, if there's no further questions before the committee, we'll adjourn at 10:07.